This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Run it.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another episode of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, of course, here to take you around the outer rim of the nostalgia mothership that was WCW and to take that voyage with me, as always, as my partner here on the show, my boy Alan the Chap. They call Alan. Alan, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much again, JT. We are on episode 16 now, and I just want to say I'm very upset with a one Parv at the moment. I've been hearing he's all over the Place to Be Nation and PWO podcasts on different podcasts at the moment. He's showing up doing one on The Greatest Wrestler Ever, I think. The Greatest Wrestler Ever, the Best WWF Wrestler Ever. Mm-hmm. He was talking about one of his favourites, IRS, for a good 20 minutes with Will and Johnny Sorrow on one of the latest episodes of that show. So it was good to hear him back, and hopefully we might get a cameo off him in the future, JT, fingers crossed. He's a very hard man to track down, but it'd be pretty cool to reunite the band again, the three of us who did a lot of the Letters from Kayfabe stuff. You were in the event center at the time, but you were still heavily involved in the show, so it'd be cool to have him, you know, do a run-in for maybe one show in the future.
Yeah, maybe we can get him to break down. It's been hard sitting on that news of the four-year considerations. I did know for a while that those had been recorded, so yeah, Parv's back on the airwaves. It'll probably be very, very limited, I'm sure. But who knows? Maybe he'll show up for maybe episode 20. You know, when we pass the record, he'll come on to kind of pass the torch over to the new record holders if we get to episode 21 or something like that. But we'll see.
Right. Well, we'll forget about Parv for now because he's not
easy.
He's not wanted to. Yeah, and we'll move on with the first question.
Okay, sounds good. Let's do it.
I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Okay, hi, Alan and JT. WCW had many favourite commentators. Who were some of your favourites and least favourites? And that's from Jason Ball in Birmingham, England, via email. So thank you very much for the question there, Jason. So over the years, WCW had a fair few commentators come and go throughout the promotion, JT. So... Mm-hmm. I've kind of looked at this and listed who has actually commentated in WCW, and I'll go through that list now, and then we kind of talk about some of the guys. So okay. The main guys that we had on commentary team, we had Bobby Heenan. It was 94 to 2000. We had Scott Hudson, 97 to 2001. Mark Madden, who was around on and off 94 to 2000. Mean Gene Okerlund, who was late 93 all the way to the end in 2001. We had Jesse Ventura. Pamela Polshock, who I don't remember at all. You'll have to fill me in on that one in a little while. Jim Ross, Tony Schiavone, Gordon Solie, Mike Tenay, Larry Zbysko, Steve McMichael, Lee Marshall, Paulie Dangerously, Stevie Ray, Jeremy Borash, Disco Inferno, Terry Funk, and Dusty Rhodes. Is there anyone off the top of your head that I'm missing from that? Jim Cornette as well, sorry.
Right.
Bob Caudle, there's another one that I didn't list.
Hoovy, do you have a Hoovy juice on there? I remember he did a Thunder for a while. He was interesting on that show.
I have literally no memories of that.
Oh, yeah. That's where he really started to break out his persona, I think, was when he was doing that. I don't know. I can't remember if he was full-time or not, but I do remember him definitely doing commentary during that one period where he had some big relevance, and even Rock referenced him, if you remember. Like, weren't you just wrestling someone called Juventud? Remember? So,
oh, yeah.
It looks like he just maybe did a couple episodes at one point late in 99. So, did you say our buddy Lee Marshall? Yeah, you did. Yeah, no, I think you caught pretty much everyone. It's... kind of a who's who. Pamela Polshock was pretty much just a backstage interviewer. I don't remember her really doing commentary. And then she ends up, I feel some there's some angle with her and Gene where she's getting bullied and like Gene ends up saving her or something. I don't think they were adversarial. I think they were like friendly, but she was pretty much just like a backstage interviewer during that time. That's it.
I'll tell you someone I've forgotten.
More to it. Yeah.
I've forgotten Eric Bischoff, of course.
Oh, of course. Yeah. How can we forget him?
The main man. So, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of guys we can talk about here. So let's just start off with who are some of our favorites. So let's get it out of the way first. Lance Russell, greatest commentator, in my opinion, of all time. Total favorite of mine in Memphis, in NWA, WCW in 89. I thought it was great and into 1990. So he's my number one. No doubt about it. Not for discussion with me. No one can. Lance is the best commentator of all time, in my opinion. So that's my favorite.
Bob Caudle?
Yeah, we mentioned Bob Caudle. I think I touched on that as well, just as a couple that I forgot.
Okay. Yep, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, when I think WCW, I mean, obviously Soli comes into mind. I've just never really been a big Soli fan. I don't know. I think I just missed the era when his voice. It's like people grow up now that listen to Gorilla Monsoon and are like, oh, God. But, you know, I think it just depends on what era you come up in. And I understand why he's liked. I just don't personally care for him. When I think WCW, honestly, I think Tony Schiavone. Like he's the voice of WCW to me. Even though Jim Ross was it for a while, and I think he was really good in WCW, obviously. But I liked Tony and Jesse as my favorite pair of all time in WCW. I thought they were fantastic in 1993. And even Tony and Bobby before Bobby really just kind of gave up, like for that first year when Bobby kind of cared. I thought they were really funny too. By the end, obviously Tony was kind of mailing it in, but he cares and doesn't phone it in as early as a lot of other people do, or maybe think that he did. Like in my mind, he was always kind of me like when the NWO started, he stopped caring, but he really is fine until I think when everything just goes completely off the rails toward the end of 98 into 99, when everything is just falling apart is when he really just stops giving a shit. But I think through 98, or at least through 97, like he's still really good. I mean, he's the glue that holds Nitro together for sure. He's got the knowledge of the history of WCW that he can bring into the commentary that he does on the newer shows. Like he's been there through pretty much everything. So he adds a nice balance of credibility. He knows enough of calling the action. He's not like an old school Vince McMahon. Oh, what a maneuver. You know, he actually knew what he was doing out there calling the action. And he could be the straight man for the comedy too. I mean, he was a little nerdy, a little hokey, but whatever. I mean, most play-by-play guys are. So he's probably my favorite WCW guy just because of what he meant to the promotion and how long he was there. And to me, he's just the voice when you think about it.
One of the most startling, one of the most disappointing, disheartening events in the history of our sport. The darkest moment in the history of our sport. 2 hours that have set the standard in our sport. 1 week away removed. For one of the most blatant attacks in the history of our sport.
It's going to be the biggest battleground in the history of our sport.
The biggest match in pro wrestling history.
The two biggest superstars in our sport in the biggest event this sport has ever seen. The biggest match in the history of our sport.
6 days away from the biggest night the sport has ever seen.
Two biggest stars in the history of professional wrestling in what will go down as the grandest night ever.
Professional wrestling history as the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
And what will go down as the biggest night in the history of this grand sport?
Yeah, he was around for so many years. I mean, he went into WWF in 89 and he had a bit of a cup of coffee with them and then came back again. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing I like with Tony Schiavone as well is he wouldn't mind having the other guys on in the booth would say Jesse Ventura poke fun at him.
Oh, for
he didn't
sure.
have an e- he didn't have an ego as much as you could sense from like a Jim Ross who would kind of take things a bit personally.
Right.
I think Tony Schiavone was always for the good of the company, and throughout his run it was evident. I mean, like everyone else, at the end of his run in late 90s, he didn't care. And well, do you blame him?
No, he was like an abused spouse. I mean, him and Ric Flair, they had been through so much and they just hung around, and even Sting. I mean, they hung around and hung around and hung around. And finally, it's like, All right, I'm not leaving because I care too much to not break up the family, but I'm kind of sick of all this, and I just want it to end. Like, that's kind of where he was at by the end of it. At some point, you're just a battered spouse. You know, it's like you're just done with the whole thing. It's like you can't take it anymore, the abuse. And they just kind of gave up at the end, especially, too, when, you know, Bobby gets fired pretty much, and or at least sent to the sidelines, and they have Mark Madden take over, and he was kind of a mess, that whole thing. And then Hudson pretty much takes over for Tony toward the end anyway. So it was yeah, I mean, whatever. It is what it is as far as where things went. But good for him for hanging on. And I do wonder how his career would have been differently if he would have been able to hang on with WWF longer than he did, if he could have built himself up as a, you know, just a player like a Jim Ross, who would, yeah, got fired like multiple times but kept coming back and hung around and became a fabric of that promotion. I do wonder if Tony could have fostered a better role for himself in WWF long term, if he even wanted it. You know, if he had stuck it out in the early 90s, and even if he was relegated to a lower level, maybe work his way up and get more and more duty as things got bigger. So I do wonder where he could have, you know, flushed out if he had stayed there.
So a question I've got for you here is, do you think it worked that WCW had different announcers on the same show for different hours? So say, case in point, be Nitro. You'd have like 1 hour, you'd have, say, Tony Schiavone and Mark Madden, and then you'd have Tony Schiavone and Larry Zbysko, and Bobby Heenan shows up and disappears, and Eric Bischoff. You know, did you feel that WWF, they seemed to keep the same guys throughout the show? Do you think that helped the show flow better than what WCW did?
Well, so WWF actually tries to copy them in 96, because they do the whole, or in 97 when they first do the 2 hours, because they would do, was it a JR and was it Kevin did like the first hour and then King would come out? Remember, they definitely did where they mixed it up, or Vince. It was like something where it was like Vince and, or no, was it Kevin instead of Vince? It was something like that, where it was like Kevin and JR did the first hour and then Vince, JR, and King did the second. It was something weird like that, where they definitely mixed it up. No, I think it worked once, especially once Bischoff went NWO and Schiavone was the voice throughout the whole episode. It did get a little wonky sometimes, where Tony and Larry would do the first hour, and then Eric and Bobby and Mongo would do the second hour. Once Eric stopped announcing, and it was just Tony, Larry, and Tanay in the first hour, and then Larry leaves and Bobby comes in for the second hour. Like, I thought that worked, because you still have the one main voice kind of shepherding you through the show, but you get the different color perspective when Bobby pops in and Larry leaves, and you can kind of do different angles. Like, all the Larry angles that happened in the first hour once he starts getting a little more active. So I thought it worked, and I did think they used their bench pretty well. Like, they would have, especially in like that 92-ish time frame where they had a bunch of guys, like, you know, JR may be the main pay-per-view guy, but Tony would do the Saturday night, or, you know, Tony would be the host and Bischoff would be the end. Like, they definitely showcased all of their depth on all those shows.
What did you think of Terry Funk as a guy, an announcer, you know, in 89, and, you know, he did the Funk's Grill stuff, but I thought it was quite interesting because he played a heel on TV throughout that time, but he wasn't naturally a heel, or always a heel, sorry, in his run on commentary, because he would sometimes agree with the baby faces over the heels. And I think that was quite an interesting dynamic around that time, to have someone that would flip-flop and wouldn't just necessarily be always pro-heels, and I think that was quite refreshing at that time.
Yeah, no, I thought he was really good. I mean, he reminds me a lot of like a Mick Foley, too. You know, like a guy that's so adept and knowledgeable at the business, and they're a talker, so they just get in the booth and they're good at it. And it was interesting because Jesse was always kind of the same way. Like, he was mainly 95% heel, but when he had a guy he stuck to, like, even when Macho Man went face, you know, he would still kind of defend Savage a little bit. So it's like stuff like that where he had guys he hated and guys he liked. So I think it was kind of aped off of that format, which I always liked. I think it's just more realistic than just a guy that's pure heel and you know, just goes against the face at every turn.
Yeah, definitely, I agree there. So who would you say is some of your least favorites out of the guys we've listed?
I remember at the time I did not like Zbysko at the time. I've grown to like him more, like rewatching and revisiting stuff. Like, I get kind of his style better. As a kid or as a teenager watching at the time, I thought he was kind of boring, and I hated his tropes of, you know, game of chess and all the, you know, all the stuff he said at the time was easy fodder to pick on. But looking
back,
did
you not like his salute?
Just everything about him annoyed me at the time. But again, yeah, I was a 16-year-old, not really into this old guy saluting. But now I look back and I actually enjoy when he's on in these hours. No, I don't think they really had anyone that was like super. I mean, I guess Mark Madden was probably the most annoying. Yeah. Like, I thought he pretty much shocked because just when you think of that era, you think of all the Russo bullshit. And at the time, it seemed, you know, I'm not sure where you were at as a fan at the time, but for me, where I was, like, age 19, 20, very into the youth movement, right? So, and this is where the internet was at this point too, right? So everyone wants Hogan out of the fucking way. Everyone's tired of Hogan. Everyone wants the young guys. Benoit's being held down. Like, WWF is young and they get it and they're listening to the fans and they're cool, and WCW's hanging on to the old guys and they're killing themselves. And Bobby Heenan, to me, kind of represented that in a way on the commentary team. And I remember there was like a groundswell to get him out of there and replace him with Mark Madden. Like, that was not like a hated move at the time, because it felt like, okay, they're embracing the loud, brash young guy who's going to tell it like it is instead of the old, you know, Bobby hanging on. I think you get that too these days, even with Lawler, like toward the end a few years ago when everyone's just like done with him just hanging around, and you know, he was around a lot longer than Bobby was. But my point is, at the time, Mark Madden was a weird breath of fresh air, but I think he immediately got old because he just wasn't that great at it. And it is the way he bought into the Russo shit just made him really fucking annoying. But it, when it first happened, it was kind of like lauded, because it's like, oh, finally, you know, get the old guys out of here. Bobby's like cashing checks like 3 years ago. We don't need him anymore.
Now, I think with me, Mark Madden got a bit of notoriety from the hotline. He was on there and he was saying a load of stuff he shouldn't have been saying, really, that, you know, they got in trouble for later on when it kind of WWF heard about these things, and Meltzer had reported on them in the Observer. So, you know, that's how we got like this kind of cool insider, we'll shoot from the hip kind of gimmick they had going on. But yeah, I think my least favorite was anyone around that late era, really, the commentary. So even not necessarily bad, but it just reminds me of the shitness that was WCW in 2000. So that's just Scott Hudson's, you know, and Mark Madden, you mean two really there. I'm not saying that, you know, Scott Hudson's bad by any means. It's just he was around at a time that was bad. So it just conjures up memories. There's nothing that stands out about him apart from, I remember once on a Nitro in 99, he got belly to belly suplex by Rick Steiner. Randomly. I remember that. But apart from that, I don't remember much of Scott Hudson, really, in WCW. I do remember he did some of the BNC show stuff.
He was good. Yeah, he was good on that when you go back and watch some of the stuff during the Hart stretch before he became the voice of, like, the Dead era. And does he replace Tony for a while on Nitro? Or is he always with, is Tony always there? Because I know Tony's there at the end.
Well, but Scott Hudson turns up, I think it's in the middle of 99, July 99. Him and Bobby Heenan do the first and third hour of the show.
Okay.
And I think that was, he did then disappeared again. Scott Hudson didn't do TV again until 2000. He started back again April 2000 when they did the relaunch, if you remember.
All right. So, yeah, he definitely does take over for Tony for a bit. And then he just becomes part of the team. I can't remember if they tried to make him, like, anoint him the lead guy. It looks like they did for... I think it's first through third hour you're looking at, so not and. So I would say it looks like he was a lead guy for about almost a month in late 99 before. It looks like that's right before Bischoff leaves. And then Tony comes back. So maybe he was just away on vacation or taking a break or something. But anyway, so yeah, Hudson definitely brings those memories back, even though it's, again, no fault of his own, really. I mean, Stevie Ray was good for the camp, but not a great commentator. But like, he made Thunder watchable at times because he was so... you know, out of his mind. I'm on record. I'm a Mongo fan. Early on, he's a little rough. Again, good in a campy way, but I thought he figured it out. Like, once he became knowledgeable about the product and kind of, you know, a WCW diehard defender for a while there. So I thought he was good by 96-ish. And then, I mean, I really like him as a wrestler, but or not in the ring, but just as a character. But he, I don't think he's that bad. I mean, he's got his, you know, the stuff you joke about, Pepe and the Yeah Baby. Disco Inferno, I never cared for. Borash, take or leave. You know, Lee Marshall, I thought was fine. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all of them. So I don't think they ever had anyone, like, really hateable or awful. They just had guys that you're kind of done with. I'd say Madden was probably, like, net the worst guy that they had on a regular commentary basis.
Yo, Okerlund, you're in trouble tonight, old man. No Buff Bagwell here to help you, and let's face it, you're 102 years old. If I kill you, there's not a coroner in the world that won't say it's natural causes. So get your petrified, fossilized ass out here, because I need someplace to put my foot.
You know, I thought it would be a good idea to compare these two athletes to have the tail of the tape. but we couldn't find a big enough measuring tape to use on the best-looking man on television.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think I'd go with him. So just before we wrap up the question, we had Stevie Ray was a commentator in WCW. Booker T, obviously, we know he's a commentator in WWF. Who's the best commentator out of Harlem Heat?
Oh, shucky ducky, quack, quack. No, I'd have to probably, I mean, probably Booker. Like, I think Booker knows what he's talking about. He's pretty good. He just, you know, I'm curious how Booker would have been in that era. Like, he is very sportsy, like, Skip Bayless-ish, you know, like, I feel like he's taking on the qualities of, like, that first take ESPN culture, and, like, that's how he is. It's just in your face, like, you know, hot takes, like that kind of stuff. So I don't know how he would have been, like, before that era, you know, but I think he's probably better than the Stevie Ray. I mean, Stevie Ray was funny, but, you know, Fruit Booty, and that was about it. But he was, you know, he had his moments, but I would say Booker probably long term is better than him.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with you. So thank you very much for the question there, Jason. Hopefully we've gone through enough people for you and discussed them there for your liking. So we'll move on to the second question now, and this is quite a good one, actually.
Okay.
So, hi, Alan and JT. Longest question for you fine gentlemen, stemming from episode 15 in your grading of the WCW years. You said that while discussing 2001 that the company was shifting towards younger talent and that they would reportedly sign RVD. And also around the time they secured Steve Corino, he had signed a contract but was told to stay home. My question is, what roles did you see RVD and Corino having in the new Eric Bischoff led WCW in the company, if the company is staying in business? They were two of the hottest acts from ECW at the time. Absolutely love the show, good brothers. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Owen Tihan, via email. So Owen's a great guy, supporter of the show, so thank you very much for that good question there, Owen. So,
for sure.
Yeah, so we had RVD was rumored to be coming in. We had Steve Corino. So what do you think would have gone on, you know, if WCW had kept going? What kind of guys would they have used? So I think it's realistic to say there's potential that they would have had RVD. And Steve Corino was pretty much guaranteed a role there as well, but things didn't work out. So how do you think those two would have fared overall in WCW?
I think RVD would have been a star. I mean, he just had the star aura and power. Now, what may have hurt, would you know, you'd have to say, is what audience was left for WCW at that point. But if they come back short, you know, if they're not dark for too long and they're reborn without losing or shedding much more of the audience, I mean, I do think he probably becomes a star. It depends, too, how loose Bischoff lets the reins be on him. You know, he got over because Paul Heyman just let him do whatever he wanted in the ring, and, you know, he was basically just a pothead as a character. WWE obviously reined that in a bit. But he had such charisma and star power when he arrived in 01 that, I mean, it was impossible not to push him. And they're forced into it. WWF is forced into it until they eventually stamp him out. But he also had guys to work with that could do his style at a main event level. Like a Jeff Hardy had worked his way up to a star power level where they could go out there and have these crazy matches at a high-profile spot on the card. He could have, you know, in Steve Austin's best possible year in the ring, probably in 2001, he's out there with RVD. Kurt Angle at possibly his peak in the ring. So he has high-level guy Jericho, too. You know, like, he has high-level guys to work with that are in big spots on the card. If he comes to WCW and you kind of look at the guys that were around, all, and we saw this play out in the Evasion, all really solid undercard guys. But who on this main event, you know, roster, without being built up, just thrust in, besides like maybe a Rey Mysterio, is he going out there with and having an RVD match at the top of the card? I'm not sure. You know, there's awesome guys that they were rumored to have part of the roster, like an AJ Styles, Christopher Daniels, guys like that, but they weren't going to be main eventing with RVD, like, out of the gate. Yeah. So who's he feuding with? You know, does he work his way up? I mean, something with him and Ray would have been fun, but so do you bring RVD as a heel? Like, I mean, he's going to be super over when he arrives. So it's almost like, what do you do with him? Like, I don't know where he would have fought. Do you just throw him and Corino in against each other? You know, I don't know. I'm curious where your thoughts are and how they could have leveraged his talents.
Well, I think they could have done a whole ECW invasion angle, maybe, because ECW going out of business. That could have worked. I mean, Meltzer reported around the time that they were talking with David Cash, Danny Doring and Roadkill as well. So I could see those guys all, you know, coming in. You know, there's potential there for Sabu as well. He'd already been in WCW before, but he's obviously known as an ECW guy. So we can get those two feuding straight away, and RVD and Sabu. And I don't know for main event, though, because neither of them are talkers. RVD's not a great talker. Sabu's gimmick was he didn't talk. So I don't know how that would have translated to WCW.
You have Corino maybe as a mouthpiece?
Yeah, well, I mean, Carino definitely can talk. Definitely Carino at that time could go in the ring as well. Great brawler. You know, but you know that if Steve Carino is going to WCW, the first person he wants to work with is Dusty Rhodes.
Right,
which, you know,
he's
we saw that happen.
Something with Dusty and Dustin, yeah.
Yeah, we saw, you know, he did that in MLW against Dusty in 2002, I think. So,
well,
yeah, I think
actually,
where...
was Dusty... did he come back? Because he's in ECW, right, for like 2000. When did they have that feud, him and Dusty? Is that like 99, 2000 in ECW?
Yeah, I think it was 2000, I think. But, you know, if things are changing, Dusty's going to make an appearance again in WCW.
Well, he might have come back anyway, because isn't he around in early 01 when they do the shit with him and Dustin with the jackass and all that? Okay, so he comes back anyway after leaving. So, all right, so he's around.
Yeah. But yeah, the other guys that we're talking about coming in now, Meltzer was talking about, was Sean O'Hare wasn't going to come in. Sorry, he was already there, but he's going to get a major push. And that would make sense. He did have the look, this Sean O'Hare. I don't know, in ring, was he super fantastic? Could he be a main eventer? But given time, you never know. But he was never given that opportunity to kind of do that, was he?
No, definitely not. I mean, yeah. And at the time, he seemed really good in the ring. Like, he was really agile for a big man. He was probably passable enough.
Yeah,
to be carried in
me. He had a swanton, didn't he? He had a pretty cool senton bomb.
Yep, he did.
So I think other guys that Meltzer was discussing with, they're going to bring in guys from Toryumon, which is Ultimate Dragon's promotion in Japan, to kickstart a new cruiserweight division era. Which, again, those guys in that era, they were state-of-the-art guys. So Bischoff was clued up enough to kind of realize that was, you know, the way that the cruiserweight division or cruiserweight wrestlers were going, that kind of style, you know, hybrid style. So I think that would have been cool. I think that definitely would have, you know, got over with the WCW audience because they were used to the smaller guys in that type of match. So I think, again, that would have been a positive move for WCW.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. Yep.
And the guys they were talking about commentary-wise is quite interesting as well because Joey Styles was having talks with Bischoff after the Guilty as Charged pay-per-view because there's no more ECW Hardcore TV tapings. So Eric, and this is what he says, Styles, he said, Eric sent me to meet with Brian Bedell in Manhattan to talk about where I would go for WCW. I would be the lead announcer and I would work in digital media. I did not agree to this until it was obvious that ECW was finished. And then Styles and Bischoff even talked about who would join him on the commentary desk. And Styles suggested Don Callis as his co-commentator because they work well in ECW. But there was a chance that Jerry Lawler may have come in because he was on the outs, if you remember, with WWF about the whole cat firing. So you can see, from Eric Bischoff's point of view, you're going to use Jerry Lawler over Don Callis, aren't you? Just for name value alone.
All day. And, you know, Bischoff loves sticking it to WWF. So King walked out. He wasn't fired, right? So he walked out on Vince and then walks out on the rebranded Nitro. And King, I mean, he was starting to wear thin a bit. Like the puppy stuff was an overdrive and all that. And I remember, like, being kind of happy when he left for Heyman. Like, I thought it was an upgrade. But he was still a big enough name and the voice of the Attitude Era. This isn't like him jumping ship in like 2008. You know what I mean? Like, he would have been a pretty big name to go to WCW, and him and Styles would have had a natural chemistry because of all the anti-ECW stuff, right? So they could have played that up right away, that their old rivalry, and they're going to be antagonizing each other. And Callis would have been good maybe for like the B shows or whatever, or maybe he does the first hour if they do that still, the first hour Nitro. King does the second hour, something along those lines. You know, I just espoused my love for Tony Schiavone earlier, but they definitely needed, if this was going to happen and they were going to reboot, they would have needed a clean slate across the board. You can't roll Schiavone back out there with the same. I mean, they would have needed a completely different attitude, voice, and they could have really played up that, hey, you know, we're teaming up with ECW in a way, like not straight up saying it, but basically we're bringing their best talent here because they went out of business and we're going to forge ahead. I think it's one of those great what ifs, like, on one hand, WDF ended up with the videotape library in it and gave us so many hours of great footage that who knows if we would have ever seen otherwise. So that part of the acquisition to me was good. I wish there could be a world where WDF bought the tape library, but Eric Bischoff still resuscitated WCW. So like Vince would still have access to everything pre-01 to do what he wants to do. And then Bischoff almost starts like a net new company, names WCW in April of 01. Because I do think he had enough in the tank as a creative guy. Like, I think he had been gone enough. He would have been gone with, you know, Russo would have been out of the way. He would have had a young roster of guys, and that's what a lot of people wanted to see, was the young guys finally ascend. And he had some talent in there, and you run, you know, you reestablish Goldberg as your top face, and you got a Steiner still in there. You got Flair probably doesn't leave. So I think it could have been a good mix, and to me, it's one of the biggest, probably the biggest what if in wrestling history, besides something stupid like, you know, what if Hulk Hogan never existed? But I mean, if like something that was realistically on the table is that WCW is close to being kept alive, I do wonder how things could have went.
And another person, actually, who would probably made an appearance, and this wouldn't have worked as well, but should have been pushed, would have been China, because she was fired, wasn't she, in 2001? From right. WWF, so I think she'd have definitely got a job there. I don't know how long she'd have lasted because she had a lot of problems, but she would have been pushed, and I would imagine she'd have been pushed against guys maybe still, and that's a bit of a worry if that was going to happen.
Yeah, and you have to wonder too, like how many other guys that went to WWF in 01 and 02 go there instead, because there may be more opportunity, you know, like even like a Jerry Lynn, you know, all these guys that ended up hanging around in 01 and don't end up doing much, they just show up. And, you know, eventually, obviously, Ray goes. He probably, you know, he might have gone eventually anyway just to go get the payday. DDP is an interesting one, obviously. Tight with Bischoff. Does he still jump? You know, he's always on
record.
Well,
no, he wasn't going to. I mean, he goes on record, like you said there. He's sorry to jump in there. He's his buddy, he's Eric Bischoff, so he can't, you know, turn around and screw him over
right.
and go to WWF. He felt that a loyalty for Bischoff. So if Bischoff had bought it, he'd have stayed, and history would have been different for his career. You know, he may have had a few more years on top than unfortunately didn't have, but he was getting older around this time. I mean, I know he'd only been on top for a number of years, but he was mid-40s, so maybe the route he did go was, you know, best for him. But he could still, you know, go in the ring, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And he would have had the built-in audience there. It would have been good if they could have retained him. And, I mean, there's other guys, too, that get released or fired from WWF that maybe they're out there, or maybe guys start jumping again if they offer the right money, like a guy like Eddie Guerrero, right? He gets fired in early 01. If he gets cleaned up, who's not to say there's suddenly a bidding war and Bischoff tries to bring him back home to WCW? Does that help them big time in 02? Because he comes in 02 and he's immediately like one of the best workers on the WWF roster when he returns. So you do wonder like where this would have shaken out. Is Hulk Hogan, you know, does he eventually go back to WCW? Like, who knows? Like, did the NWO ever go back, or has Bischoff washed his hands of all that and say, I don't want anything to do with these guys again? I'm starting young. Or does he bring in Hogan as an ambassador of some sort? So, I mean, his name was still kind of poisonous on the internet until WrestleMania 18. So I don't know what he does, but you know, there's just a lot of big names that are out there that you wonder where they go.
Well, here's one more that I've just thought of is Bob Sapp.
Yeah,
because he was around, wasn't he? He showed up on Thunder a few times and did some things, but he had the look, he had the cred. You know, he's a wacky guy. He's, you know, he's wacky on, you know, on the mic a bit. He's been in films now, so people have seen him in, was it The Longest Yard he was in, where he was crying all the time through that film? Yeah, he was in that. But yeah, he's all right. He was someone I think would have, you know, done okay in WCW if they'd rebooted. But hey, I've got a list together here, JT, of some of guys I think may have been the roster around 2001 time. So I'll go through it. We've got Scott Steiner, Booker T, Young Dragons, Three Count, Billy Kidman, Rey Mysterio, Sugar Shane Helms, Chavo Guerrero, Lance Storm, Mike Awesome, Elix Skipper, Sean O'Hare, Chuck Palumbo, Sean Stasiak, Bam Bam Bigelow, Stacey Keebler, DDP, Kid Romeo, Ric Flair, Sting, Air Paris and AJ Styles, Dustin Rhodes, Jason Jett, Kid Cash, Rick Steiner, Canyon, The Cat, Hugh Morris, Jeff Jarrett, Mike Sanders, Kwee Wee, Conan, Alex Wright, Disco, Inferno, Reno, Big Vito, Luger, Buff Bagwell, Rob Van Dam, Sabu, Goldberg, Carino, D'Lo Brown, Billy Gunn, Bob Sapp, Sam Greco, and Chris Daniels. So that's a fair roster there, really, isn't it? There's plenty of guys, plenty of kind of directions they could go in, those type of guys. And they're likely guys that could have, you know, come in. Not saying that would have happened. Mm-hmm. It's just all, we're just guesswork here, and we're just kind of doing a bit of fantasy booking in a way. But I think it's realistic that those type of guys could make a WCW roster. And that roster's not too bad overall, really.
No, it's not. And I don't know if it would have even been that big. I guess it depends on how much TV they end up retaining. Like, do they keep Nitro and Thunder? Did Thunder ever get canceled, or was it around to the end? Do you know?
I think it was around to the end, I think. Okay. I don't think it ever got canceled.
Yeah, you're right. March 21st, 01. So, yeah, I mean, you wonder if they keep Thunder? Do they keep... obviously, Nitro had already gone back to 2 hours, I believe. They were not 3 hours at the end. So, you know, how does that flesh out? So how many guys do you really need to fill out the roster? And do they turf some of these old guys? Like, do they really run a Rick Steiner around? I mean, I guess as long as you're pushing Scott, Rick's probably part of the package. Like a Luger, a Bagwell. Like, do you need these guys anymore? Or are you going full youth movement? That's one of the biggest questions that's probably out there for them. But, I mean, they still had, you know, bankable guys that could go in the ring, like a Lance Storm, like a Bam Bam Bigelow. Like, guys that could work, that had some name value, that had good years the year before. And yeah, you got to wonder too, what, you know, I know we're not going down this path, but what does WWF look like without the invasion and the buyout? Like, how does that year play out? You know, where do they go basically? So it's very interesting. It's one of those things that I really wish we could have seen what the alternate timeline looked like with Fusion buying WCW and TNT not canceling them and not killing it off for good. Where would we be? Would we even be doing the show? Because they'd still be going strong. I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing it just morphs into some amalgamation of Ring of Honor and TNA at some point, right? I mean, that's pretty much what it is. So
yeah,
it just depends on if they could have kept it on TV. And it sounds like, who knows with TNT if that was ever a possibility. But you wonder too, you know, could USA have gotten the hankering and maybe brought them over there? Like, if WWF stays on TNN when they jump, you know what I mean? Like, I know at the time they were kind of done with wrestling, USA was, but they were back, you know, kind of hankering for it by the mid-2000s. Do they do something there? So, or does WCW end up on Spike where TNA did? So there's so many questions. If they could have just gotten a life machine. If you look what TNA has done in all the nine lives they've had, it is amazing that WCW died on the vine like it did. Like, if they could have just made it like two more years, they probably could have had this run like TNA has had, where they just keep finding ways to stay alive with the new media coming on online, with you know, being able to watch on the internet and have your own network and streaming. Like if they could have survived to this point, who knows what they could have done? And I think if they could have just made it to like 03, they could have set themselves up for a bigger run. I think that just, they died like a year and a half earlier than an era that could have maybe saved them. And who knows? Maybe when Shane McMahon has his fight with Vince in 2008, he goes to WCW. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, there's other things. They still have had the links to New Japan, so they could have used those guys, you know, as well. And obviously with New Japan, with All Japan going under, you've got access to guys that were working, you know, New Japan shows that were All Japan guys as well in the past. So there's lots of things that they could have done, you know, that was interesting. But it's one of those what-ifs, isn't it, unfortunately, JT? So hopefully we've answered the question fully there for Owen. That was a great question. I enjoyed going through that one there. So if you've got any more questions for us, Owen, send them our way into the plunder bucket. So it's that time of the week, JT.
Let's do it. Alan's going to go ahead and hop in his car because it is the 1-800-CLICK-ROAD-REPORT, looking at this week in history with the chap called Alan.
I'm in suburban Detroit, Michigan, at the Palace of Auburn Hills for the 100th episode of WCW Nitro, and that was on This Week in WCW History, August the 4th, 97. And this is a real landmark show, JT, because this is when Lex Luger defeated Hollywood Hulk Hogan by submission to win the WCW World Heavyweight title. And this ended Hogan's run as champion. A good thing, would you say, JT, for Luger to be stepping up at this time? Because from my memory, Luger was over as hell, and it was just the right time for Luger to get the belt.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, you know, there's the question of should they have just done it at Road Wild and then got it back on Hogan later. I mean, his run is kind of crappy. But you know what? The way they sell it, like, and this has come from someone who's just watched all this. Like, I've been watching the Nitros and everything, and I'm actually right after the show on my watch. And they really needed, like, a WCW win, a big victory. And that's how this is heralded. So it's like, even though his title reign is short, they still got a huge win on the NWO. And it established Luger as the guy until Sting comes back. The moment is really cool. Like, you know, it's infamous where he's got him in the rack and Randy Anderson's like, holy shit, he submitted, and he starts calling for the bell. Like, it's such a great moment, and everyone comes out and they're all celebrating.
About for so long.
Hogan's flipping out the NWO backstage. And, you know, I thought it was really cool. I thought for that one moment, they did really well. And this is during a very hot time in Nitro. A lot was going on. You had all this stuff going on with Kurt Hennig and Raven, you know, teasing them as when they were going to start wrestling, and, you know, what Hennig was going to do. Was he part of the NWO? Was he part of the Horsemen? They were doing a lot of kind of stuff. You know, Six was running wild on Nitro as well. They had a lot of stuff here. He fights, what do you know, fighting, or just got involved in DDP versus Flair. I thought he had a match on this one, but DDP Flair too, they kind of had their thing going on because DDP was pissed at Hennig. Because he had turned on him back at the pay-per-view. So, like, there's all these intertwined feuds. Oh, Benoit defeated Six. That's what it was. There's a lot of good stuff in here on this episode, but that, to me, was a really great moment and one of the most memorable Nitros. I think it's cool that they made it the 100th episode where they did this. They made it the three-hour Nitro that they rarely did. I think this is maybe only, like, the second one that they had done. And I thought it made it seem like a very memorable moment. And other stuff that happened, too. You had Bischoff kind of pushing his thing forward with Larry Zbysko. J.J. Dillon comes out and gets in Eric Bischoff's face. And Bischoff had his thing going on with the Giant where he had the restraining order against him. So there's a lot of really great promo and storyline stuff in this episode, too.
Yeah, this to me, maybe the peak of the Nitro era, really. Everything came together. Everything worked out. And this was... everything just worked, and this is an awesome episode. I mean, if no one's seen this match with Luger and Hogan, you need to check it out because the crowd pop was massive. Everyone was just so into seeing this title change. WCW did what everyone wanted. It worked. Everything worked perfectly. And of course, they don't learn from this, and the wheels start falling off into 98 and 99, which we've documented plenty of times already on this show. But for this one night, WCW was perfect. Yeah, which I think is fair to say.
Do you think that Luger should have kept it?
Well, he had the momentum. He was over, wasn't he? This was a culmination of Luger just heating up. And I never thought that Luger would get to this point again. I mean, he was over in pockets at different times in his career. But he was the man in the promotion at this point in some ways, wasn't he? And I think we'd never really seen that before because you'd always have, you know, Sting was in the background still. That's fair enough. Sting's still hovering over WCW and he gets the title off Hogan at Starrcade, as you know. But someone that's on TV as a face every week, Luger was the guy. And I think Luger could have had a few months with this, but then how would that have played out with Sting? And that was the problem. Right. WCW booked themselves into this long-term storyline, so Luger was only ever going to be the short-term champion, I think, which is unfortunate, but that's just the way that the booking went. And obviously the big money match was going to be Sting versus Hogan at Starrcade. So I can't blame them for taking the title off Luger, but it was a nice moment. And looking back, it's cool.
And in a way, it almost helps the Sting storyline too, because it's like, oh, we thought we had him. Hogan takes it right back, and I always get the stranglehold again, and here we are again. Like, who is going to finally do? We thought we had the guy in Luger, and it just didn't work out. And you couldn't even say give it to Luger earlier and let him run with it, because that August was like, that was just the perfect time. Like, he had just crested right into that match. I think it went the way it had to go, unfortunately. Like, I do think he deserved a longer run with the belt, and, like, this is his peak, but you can't. You can't jeopardize what you had been building with Hogan Sting and, you know, payoff, you know, regardless of how the payoff went in the end. Obviously, they ended up botching it. But at that time, you're looking ahead to saying we have to have Sting be the guy that ends this mammoth run of, you know, just him dominating the title. And, yeah, Luger gets the blip. But it helped them to just reestablish. Like, Hogan wins it back on the anniversary of when he won it the first time at Road Wild the year before. So there's a lot of symmetry to it. So, yeah, I think it went the way it should have gone.
Yeah, I think it's a good moment in history, so I'm glad we were able to cover that on this week's show. So, shall we now go on to the long question for the episode, JT?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so, hi, JT and Ellen. I'd love to know how much WCW wrestlers earned. Was it more than WWE guys at the same time? Keep up the great work, and that's from David Michael Harwood in Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina. So, thank you very much for the question there, David. Appreciate it. So, I've got some information here, JT. We've got some figures, and I'm going to thank someone for this first. This is Mookie Garner, someone that people may not know who listen to the show. Mookie Garner is someone who does a hell of a lot of great work on kind of wrestling, you know, figures, facts. He does a radio show on Voices of Wrestling, you know, a podcast called The WrestleNomics with Brandon Howard. They're two guys that cover the WWE business in depth. And the guys that dig out a lot of these old kind of case files from court. And this is where we got this information from, because there was a racial discrimination lawsuit. It was WCW versus Sonny Ono. And that was, you know, went on in 2000, I think, when there was the whole WCW being racist towards certain talent. So to prove how much talent, and this was kind of had to be shown in court. So Mookie Garner did some great work and analytics of this. So what we should do, JT, is actually put the link to the site where we got this information from on the show notes, because it's really interesting, because we can't go through it all, but you know, you can spend a good 20-30 minutes looking through all the kind of figures here of how much people earned, and it's really interesting. So is there anything that stood out to you looking at it initially, JT?
Yeah, it's a lot of money going across people here. I mean, Hogan stands out, obviously, from 96 to 2000, made, you know, over $13 million in that five-year stretch. And to me, it's kind of surprising that Goldberg checks in second during that five-year stretch or four-and-a-half-year stretch, because he's not really a big star until the middle of 98. So he really made his money on the back of 98 and 99. I mean, he makes... 99-2000, because he doesn't make much before then. Like, he barely makes $750,000 before then. So it's really 99-2000 he gets his big salary payday, and that was enough to make him the second highest paid guy during the stretch, even more than a Kevin Nash that you thought would be the highest paid. And surprisingly enough, Bret Hart comes in. And the one that makes me laugh the most is he made $43,000 from them in 1997, and he's only there for like 3 weeks. So yeah, that was like crazy to think about. And when you see the figures here, I do wonder if this is like, I guess, I don't know if it's post-tax or whatever, but because it wasn't his deal rumored to be 3 years, so $3 million a year. So this all seems a little bit lower. And I know 2000, he ends up getting hurt and leaving, so he only gets half of it. But so I don't know if this is post-tax or what it was. But
it's got to be, because if you think it's after tax, $2.6 million for 98 and 99, right, you know, it would have been $3 million. Yeah. One that's interesting for me is Sting. So in 96, he got $87,000. That's it. I don't know why, because comparably, you know, in 96, even like a DDP was getting $150,000. Right. Scott Steiner in 96, 156. So I've no idea why. But then inversely, in 97, when he didn't do anything, you know, working wise, I mean, he showed up at Nitro and he was, you know, involved in angles and things, but he got, you know, $960,000 in 97. I think, do you think some of that was danger money for doing the thing down to the ring?
No, I think it was part of his contract. I mean, there has to be some back end, maybe like 96, that was the last year of his deal or something like that, and he was just, you know, an old deal that he had hanging around from like the Watts era or something. You know, like, it's such a dramatic difference from other guys that came in after, so it just makes me think it's something he signed in like 92 that was just paying him out, because all these other guys, you know, maybe would have re-signed later on or something after. I mean, that's all I can think of. Either that or he just had a front-loaded deal and the last year was always meant to be kind of low. Or it's just wrong. I mean, it's just possible. It's meant to be $870,000 or something. Because, I mean, Savage is making, you know, $750,000 in 96. Fucking Hogan making $2 million, which is crazy. Because then he dips big in 97, too. But he was, I mean, there's always a rumor, too. Wasn't, like, Turner paying part of his contract that year or something like that? Yeah. You know, and then you move on down the list. Like, some guys still make good money. Like, freaking Dennis Rodman, you know, made over $1 million in 1999. And did he even wrestle? What did he have? The one match with Savage in 99? That must have been a payment, a leftover payment. Because he worked in 97, so I don't know. I'm not sure if that's off as well. But
well, it could have been paid for by Turner.
Oh, by Turner, right? Yeah,
WCW. You know, some other deal. The one that stands out to me here, really, just above Dennis Rodman, we've got Ric Flair is the 13th highest paid guy between 96 and 2000. That just shows you how much they value Flair versus how much the fans valued him. I mean, is it below guys like Booker T, Scott Steiner, Roddy Piper, DDP, Scott Hall, Luger, Nash, Sting, Savage, Bret Hart, Goldberg, and Hogan? And then just one below Ric Flair, we have one of the shittest workers ever, Conan. What the hell is Conan doing on, you know, $1.7 million in total?
He was probably getting paid on, I mean, he was probably skimming from the AAA guy or the guys he brought in, right, from his Mexican deal. Like, he was probably, because he was like
percentage.
He was the coordinator of all the cruisers coming in. So he was probably getting some kind of payment off of that. Flair, I guess loyalty. He didn't make much in 99, and he's well below everyone else in 2000. So I don't know what was going on there, if he took. Because 98 was when he was going to walk, right? And then he comes back. So I'm not sure. Again,
knowing Flair, he may have took a loan out with WCW.
Yeah, that's true, too.
His salary.
Or maybe he signed something with Turner, too. I mean, it's hard to know, like, with some of these guys. I mean, you know, Steiner and Booker, they're main eventers in 2000. So they're making main event money. They were headlining a lot of those pay-per-views and shows. I don't know if everyone had a guaranteed contract. I'm not sure with WCW. But DDP, obviously, you can see his evolution working his way up the scale. He didn't make barely anything in 97. And that was one of his best years as far as like just as a worker. So it's interesting seeing the scale like that. Even like a guy like Kevin Green made $1 million from WCW, which is, you know, he only wrestled probably like a handful of times, if that.
Yeah, but there's, I've got some other good ones here. If you go and look at, I don't know, the guys that are on the $400,000 range.
Yeah.
Total. Look at six.
That makes me laugh. I was just looking at that one.
Yeah, I mean, look, we go from, I mean, he jumped ship and he was all over everywhere. But in 2000, he earned, or mid-2000, up to mid-2000, they sent him a check for a dollar. And that's listed.
See, I'm curious, too, does this count royalties like merchandise? Because that could be.
It must do.
Yeah, so that probably explains why, because he left in 98, and he made $3,000 in 99, so he must have still been getting money from, like, NWO merchandise or figure sales. It had to be something that was still getting him paid during that stretch.
Yeah, Lance Storm didn't do too badly in 2000. He got $383,000. That was, you know, that's not bad for, and that's not all of 2000 these figures are from. I think it's up to May 2000. So if that's up to May 2000, Lance Storm's looking at, you know, $750,000. That's not bad for Lance Storm, is it really?
There's some funny ones, too, that make me laugh, like guys that never even wrestled, like Kevin Kelly, the other Kevin Kelly, Nails. You know, he was signed in 98, 99, made $250,000, never wrestled. I don't think he ever even appeared. I'm trying to look. Is Lanny Poffo on this list? Wasn't he getting
paid?
Well,
that's what we want. He's got to be, hasn't he?
Yeah,
somewhere.
I'm looking for him.
Because we did. Oh, let's just talk about someone. We've got the Gambler.
Oh, where
We've
is he?
The Gambler here. Oh, he's further down.
I see him.
Oh, yeah. $32,000 in 96, 31 in 97, 32 in 98, and 22 in 99. Totaling $118,000. For a guy that was just turning up at TV tapings, you know, and he could have had another job or done something else as a sideline.
He's a welder, as we know.
Oh, yeah, he was gambling it all, wasn't he? That's what he was doing with it all. Of course, but that, I mean, this is really interesting to kind of look at, and I think it's really important that we do post a link to this so, you know, Mookie Garner gets some love and, you know, the listeners can, you know, go through this because there's loads of little anomalies. Like, why did Mark Jindrak get $120 in 98? Was that just so to pay him to go to the power plant? But why $120?
Yeah, it could have been like a TV appearance, like if he wrestled a match on Saturday night, maybe it was like
a squash
payment or something.
Looking.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the lowest paid guys then who worked every year, I'm just trying to look. If you can see everyone that's filled out, we've got Steve Armstrong. Overall, he worked every year and he earned $168,000 over them all. Is there anyone else lower than him that worked every year that's listed?
The rest look like they're pretty much just spotty here and there, wrestling, you know, a year or two. I think it's Blitzkrieg wrestled probably as many years as Scott Armstrong. He made around the same money. There you go. There's your Bob Sapp. You got paid, apparently, in 2000. I do like seeing ICP on here. Shaggy Sudo making $57,000 in 2000, or in 99.
I like. Oh, Lanny Poffo is here.
Where is he?
I found him. Right near the bottom. But this doesn't make sense from the stories. I don't know what went on here, but in 98, he got paid $4,521.
Yeah, I always thought he was on a contract for longer than that. So.
Well, that's what I'm now... Yeah. Going against my own research that I did for the one where we discussed that, you know, right. The guys that have been in WCW and paid. We've got above him, though, we've got Bruno Sammartino, who did like some, we talked about him as well in WCW. He got $5,000 in 96 for showing up and refereeing, you know, on house shows and things. I would have thought he got more than that, maybe, but obviously not. One Man Gang, there's an interesting one. He had the US title run, didn't he, in 96? Mm-hmm. He only got paid $10,000.
Well, I mean, we're seeing a trend in 96. I mean, outside of like Savage and Hogan, I don't think anyone was making any money in 96. I mean, everyone's pretty low. You know, Ray Traylor made $200,000, Benoit, $100,000. I mean, so yeah, it's not like huge money in that year, honestly. I mean, Flair made $500,000 and Savage and Hogan, that's about it.
But it's just, I could talk about this all. This is a really good topic, actually, because we could pick out this list. You know, I've looked at Louis Spicoli. He earned $27,000 in total because he unfortunately passed away in 98. But in 97, he earned just $17,000. And he was all over the TV, wasn't he?
I mean,
he was part of kind of the NWO lackey. He was knocking around with Scott Hall just to get $17,000. And we've got that Big Bam Vader was still getting money from WCW in 96 and 97. He made $15,000, you know, just for maybe using his likeness or whatever in something. So, yeah, is there anyone else before we wrap up the question? Because as I said, we can talk about this, you know, hour for hours and hours. Is there anyone else that you want to kind of jump out at you?
I think we covered all the big ones. I mean, Arn didn't get paid a ton either. He was making kind of okay money for his 3 years where he was active, or 2 years, I should say. No, there's no one else that really jumps up. It is worth a look. Like you said, we'll link it in the post. It's worth checking out just for toilet reading, whatever else you want to check it out. It's interesting just to kind of go through and see. You know what else is interesting for? Just to see all the names, like all the guys that passed through there, like just random one-offs you may have forgotten about, just lower on the list. So it's kind of cool to look at it from that perspective.
Yeah, like Swole, $30,000 in 99. You know, there's just great guys there as well. Randomly, Steve Austin got a payment of $29,000 in 2000, but nothing before. Weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you wonder if, I don't know. Was it like an outstanding payment or lawsuit? I mean, they might have had, because he got, I don't know. I have no idea. Weird.
But this is all legit figures that the WCW legally obliged to give in a court. So they're not like internet rumors. These are real figures. So
Do we know if that's the real Steve Austin? Like, I guess they are using gimmick names here, so.
I didn't know, the one below Steve Austin.
I didn't know if there was a guy whose real name was Steve Austin. Yeah.
Well, that's really good to go through that. So, we'll definitely post that in the show notes for the episode. So that hopefully answers the question there. So that comes to the end of the show, JT. I've had a blast recording this one. We've had sort of varied topics, but I think it's not been a very YouTube playlist heavy show, really. So I don't think we're going to have a YouTube playlist this episode. So hopefully guys don't mind us not doing that, but we'll be back with one hopefully for the next episode.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it was more of a conversational topic. Probably one, as you've heard by this point, probably not a ton of audio drops either, just the way this one went. But it was a fun episode. It was a lot of good topics and kind of looking at more of the behind the scenes of WCW. Hopefully everyone enjoyed the interview with the Gambler's Son as well on last episode, episode 15. That was a great time with Jeff Gann, so we really enjoyed that as well. So be sure to check this show out each and every Friday. Of course, you can check out all of our other podcasts and Podblast. We have tons of things dropping left and right each and every day. So be sure to subscribe to our feeds on iTunes, PlayStation Wrestling, PlayStation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. Follow us on social media, facebook.com/PlayStation. And of course, join us in the comments at PlayStation.com. We have discussion threads each and every day. Every post has its own thread as well to have comments in there. So join in the conversation.
Yeah, do that, guys. It's well worth checking out all the shows on the feeds. We've got some great stuff, and even the stuff with Parv is okay as well. So, yeah, definitely do that. So thank you very much for listening to the show, guys. We hope for you to come on next week. And before we go, JT, we've forgotten how do guys actually get the questions in. I'll just mention that the best way to do that is on Twitter or on email, or you can comment on the bottom of when the show's posted on Place to Be Nation on there. So Twitter, it's at @Alan_CheapShot. JT's at @Place2BNation. And you can email letters from centerstage@gmail.com if you want to do us that way. And as I said, you can also comment at the bottom of the show itself and ask the question that way. So yeah, it's been a hoot this week, JT. Hopefully we'll be back on next week and have some more great questions.
Sounds like a plan to me. We'll be here. For Alan, I'm JT. We're out. We'll talk to you in a week. Take care.
Yo baby yo
at the Mauler, completely maul his opponent Steve Dahl.
What I've heard,
what's that shit, no softball game.
They're great.
Always go swimming with a buddy. Work real hard and always study.
All right, the Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's a guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot.
We need to hit it, booger, you.
Is it spread?
Yes.
You can't find your scissors?
Wow!